Mother drove. Jamie looked out the window at the passing houses.
It's a secret, he told himself. I won't tell anybody I went swimming with Carrie. I won't tell anybody I got my sneakers, pants, and socks wet, and I won't tell anybody about big guy who hit Carrie and pushed her in the pool. Because that's a secret, too.
Eleven. The instant he pulled into his driveway, Doug Crowley became irritated.
I told Alan the lawn should be mowed by the time we got home. Look, the front is only half finished.
The consternation on June's face matched her husband's. Their avid tennis playing kept them in good shape. Both were on the short side. Doug was 5'9" tall, with salt and pepper hair combed over to cover a growing bald spot. His even features always hinted at a scowl. June's cap-length brown hair did not do enough to soften her narrow lips and frequent frown. June and Doug had been 33 years old when they married. By then, June had her nursing degree from Rutgers, and Doug was working as a software engineer. They were joined at the hip by their mutual desire to have a beautiful home, become members of a country club, and retire by age 60. They were goal-oriented and insisted their only child be the same way. To arrive home and find a job not completed and the mower sitting in the middle of the front lawn irritated June as much as it did Doug. She was fresh on her husband's heels when they went through the door shouting their son's name. When he did not answer, they went through the rooms and found him lying atop his unmade bed, crying. As one, they began to shake him.
Alan, what happened? What's the matter?
At first, Alan could not answer. Finally, he looked up at them.
Carrie was found dead in her pool, and the police think I did it.
Doug was practically shouting,
Why do they think you did it?
Because we had an argument at her party. It was in front of a lot of the other kids, and when the detective was here,
A detective came here? June shrieked. Did you talk to him?
Yes, for a little while. He drove me to his office and asked me some questions.
Doug looked at his wife.
Did the detective have a right to do that?
I don't know. He did turn 18 last month.
She looked at her son.
Alan, exactly what happened to Carrie?
His voice halting, Alan told them what he had learned. Carrie had been found in her pool this morning.
They think somebody hit her over the head and pushed her in and she drowned.
It ran through June's mind to tell Alan that they knew how much he had cared about Carrie. There would be time for that later. Right now, the tremendous impact of what they had heard and how it might affect Alan made it absolutely necessary to protect her son any way she could. As she questioned him, she became more and more frantic. 12. After dropping Jamie at the high school, Marge drove down the block toward her home. Grace, her next-door neighbor, was watching for her from the patio on her front lawn. As soon as Marge parked the car, Grace waved her over.
Can you believe it? That poor girl, Carrie, was murdered. She had one of those teen parties the kids have when their parents are away. The police are talking to all the neighbors. They rang your doorbell. They asked me if I knew who lived in your house. I told them about you and Jamie and said I didn't know where you were.
Marge tried to conceal her anxiety.
Grace, did you say anything about Jamie?
I told them that he is a very nice young man with special needs and didn't go to the high school anymore. I guess they want to talk to everybody in the neighborhood who might have seen something.
I suppose so, Marge agreed. I'll see you later.
When Jamie came home a few hours later, Marge could see that something was disturbing him. She didn't have to ask him what it was before he said,
The girls on the soccer team were sad because Carrie went to heaven.
Jamie, a policeman is going to come and talk to us about Carrie because she got sick in the pool and went to heaven. Remember, You won't tell him that you went over to the pool.
The words were barely out of her mouth before the bell rang. Jamie started up the stairs to his room. When Marge answered the door, it was not a policeman in uniform, but a man in a suit.
I'm Detective Mike Wilson from the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office, he said.
Yes, come in, Detective,
Marge said as she gestured toward the living room.
We can sit in here and talk.
After they settled into two chairs facing each other, Mike said,
As I'm sure you are aware, Mrs. Chapman, your neighbor, Carrie Dowling, was found dead in her family's swimming pool this morning.
I did hear about it, Marge sighed. A terrible tragedy. Such a lovely young girl.
Mrs. Chapman, my understanding is that you and your son live in this home?
Yes, just the two of us.
Were the two of you home last night after 11 o'clock?
Yes, we both were.
Was anyone else with you?
No, just us.
Let me tell you why I am particularly interested in speaking to you and your son. When I was called to the Dowlings' home this morning, I stood at their backyard pool and looked around. Above the tree level, I could clearly see the upstairs room in the back of your home. That means anyone who was in that room might have seen something that could be helpful to our investigation.
Of course, Marge said.
I'd like to see that room before I leave. How is that room used?
It's a bedroom.
Your bedroom?
No, it's Jamie's bedroom.
May I speak to him?
Of course.
Marge walked over to the stairs and called up to Jamie. Detective Wilson interrupted her.
If it's okay with you, Mrs. Chapman, can I talk to Jamie in his room?
I guess that would be okay,
Marge said as she began to climb the stairs with the detective one step behind her. She knocked tentatively on Jamie's door and then opened it. He was sprawled on his bed watching a video.
Jamie, I want you to meet Detective Wilson.
Hi, Jamie,
Mike said, extending his hand forward. Jamie stood up.
I'm pleased to meet you, sir, he said as he shook hands.
He turned to Marge for her approval. Her smile confirmed to him that he had used good manners. Jamie and Marge sat on the bed. Mike went over to the window. The Dowlings and the Chapmans were backyard neighbors. He looked down at the Dowling swimming pool, then sat in the chair opposite the bed.
Jamie, I just want to talk to you for a few minutes. You know Carrie Dowling, don't you?
Yes. She's in heaven.
Wilson smiled.
That's right, Jamie. She went to heaven. But her parents and the police want to find out what happened before she went to heaven. There was a party last night at Carrie's house. Carrie didn't invite me. I know you weren't there, Jamie. It was for the kids who just graduated. I'm older. I'm 20 years old. I just had my birthday. Well, happy birthday, Jamie.
Wilson went over to the window.
Jamie, I can see Carrie's backyard and pool from here. So that means if you were in your room last night, you could too. I didn't go swimming with Carrie, Jamie said as he looked at his mother with a conspiratorial smile.
Mike smiled.
I know you didn't, Jamie. Did you see Carrie in her backyard cleaning up last night?
I help clean up at the Acme, where I work from 11 o'clock to 3 o'clock.
So you didn't see Carrie in her backyard, or see her go into the pool last night?
I did not go swimming with Carrie. I promise,
Jamie said as he put his arm around his mother and kissed her.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie. Mrs. Chapman, I'm going to leave you my card. Sometimes people recall things later. If you or Jamie think of anything that might be helpful to our investigation, please contact me.
They walked downstairs and accompanied Wilson to the front door. After Marge closed it behind him, Jamie gave her a triumphant smile and exclaimed,
I kept the secret!
Marge put her fingers to her lips and uttered, shh. She was terrified that the detective might have lingered on the porch and heard Jamie.
heart in her throat, she walked over to the front window. With a sigh of relief, she watched Wilson step off the end of her driveway, open the front door of his car, and get in. Mike started the car, but paused before he started driving. Why did he have the feeling that something about Jamie's answers sounded rehearsed?
13. While Mike Wilson focused on the four girls whose text messages were on Carrie's phone, detectives from the prosecutor's office met at the homes of Carrie's other friends who had been at the party. In most cases, the mother or father, or both, sat in. Usually, they sat on the couch on either side of their son or daughter, so tightly together that their arms were squeezing each other. Detective Harsh, who began the questioning, started with a statement to put them at ease.
I want you to know right off the bat that this investigation is not about trying to charge or arrest anyone who engaged in underage drinking that night. We know that a lot of people were. There were vodka and beer bottles all over the Dowling home and property. We don't know if anyone was using drugs that night. We do have to ask you if you were drinking or using any drugs because it's possible that that could have affected your perceptions that night or your memory today. But again, we're not looking to get anyone in trouble for those reasons. What we do want to know is if there were any arguments or fights that night, particularly any that involved Carrie Dowling.
There had been 31 individuals at Carrie's party. 8 girls had witnessed Alan and Carrie having an argument. None of the girls admitted to having anything more than a couple of beers. They all adamantly denied that there were any drugs at the party. One of the girls, Kate, who described herself as Carrie's best friend, cried as she spoke.
Alan got furious because Chris Coble kept hanging around Carrie and talking about all the fun they were going to have at Boston College. It was clear that he wanted to go out with her. I hoped they would start going out. I thought Alan was being a jerk.
Why did you think that?
Because he's so possessive of Carrie. In June, when he heard Chris had asked Carrie to go to the senior prom, he told Chris that Carrie was his girl and never to ask her out again. I told Carrie that Chris was a much nicer guy than Alan and she should smarten up and dump Alan. Then at the party, Alan had been drinking a lot of beer. He picked a fight with Chris. Carrie stepped between them and started yelling at Alan. He took off and slammed the door behind him.
How did Carrie react to that?
She looked upset for a minute, but then she shrugged it off and said, forget it.
What time did Alan leave?
I'm not sure. It was 10:30, maybe 10:45.
Did Alan come back?
No.
And what time did the party break up?
We all got out by 11. That's when neighbors call the cops if there's any noise.
Did anyone help Carrie clean up?
She said she'd do it herself. She wanted all the parked cars off the block by 11 o'clock. Carrie was very nervous about what she would do if a cop showed up when the party was still going.
I have 2 last questions. Did you go out on the patio at any point in the evening?
Oh, sure I did.
Did you notice a golf club out there?
Oh, yes, I did. The Dowlings are big golfers. They have a practice putting green on the side lawn. A couple of the guys were putting with it.
14. The unreality of what had happened to Carrie was a nightmare that dominated the few hours that Aline managed to doze on Sunday night. The events, from the first moment she had found Carrie's body in the pool, were a soundtrack running at fast-forward speed. The cop doing CPR and then shaking his head. The detective herding them into the house, trying to absorb the unspeakable. Father Frank trying to make sense of the senseless. Neighbors pouring in, offering to help in any way they can. Help with what? Grandpa Dowling in the nursing home in Florida, who would be too sick to make the trip. Mom's mother and father would be flying in tomorrow. People bringing in food that they could only pick at. Mom's constant sobbing. Dad, white-faced, lips tight. His expression grief-stricken, trying to offer comfort to Mom and me. The exhaustion of the flight home and the time change made it possible for me to fall asleep for an hour or so. And then the kaleidoscope began. At 7 o'clock, Aline sat up, threw aside the covers, and dragged herself out of bed. The day, cloudy and promising rain, was in keeping with the way she felt. She had tied back her long brown hair with a scrunchie, but it had slipped off during the night. She went over to the mirror on the dresser opposite the bed. It was as though Carrie was standing beside her, staring into it. Carrie looked like Mom with her golden blonde hair, sparkling blue eyes, perfect features. Aline was her father's child, with hazel eyes, a thin face, and deep brown hair. Mud-colored, she told herself. Her eyes were filled with grief, and she could see that she was very pale. Her pajamas were hanging loosely on her. She knew that Carrie would have taken one glance at her and said,
"Look what the cat dragged in."
An involuntary smile came to her lips and disappeared. She tiptoed down to the kitchen and made a pot of coffee. Ted Goldberg, a doctor and friend of her parents from the golf club, had come over late yesterday afternoon and given her parents sleep aids. Aline hoped that the pills they had taken before going to bed last night had worked and were giving them a measure of peace. She had taken on the task yesterday afternoon of phoning family members and close friends about the tragedy. Some were already aware after seeing news reports. It had been a comfort to read the stream of tributes that came pouring onto her sister's Facebook page. In the evening, their next-door neighbor had brought in dinner. No one had been hungry, but they had all nibbled and felt better for it. Her father had turned on the television at 6:30. A picture of their house was on the screen. The lead story was about Carrie's murder. He had rushed to click it off. Ordinarily, Aline would have turned on the morning news the moment she entered the kitchen. But she didn't want to watch stories about Carrie. Not yet. Not ever. She had left her cell phone in the dining room after making the calls. Coffee cup in hand, she went over to get it. She saw there was a voice message from a number she did not recognize. It had been left only an hour ago. It was from Mike Wilson, the detective who was handling Carrie's case. His image flashed into her mind. Handsome, a little over 6 feet tall, intense dark brown eyes, a slender athletic frame. A way of leaning forward, hands clasped, as though to avoid missing any word that was said. She tapped on the message.
"Ms. Dowling, I know how rough everything is for you at this point, but I need your help. I hope I'm not calling too early. I understand that you are a guidance counselor at Saddle River High School. I think you could be a great help to me. Please call me as soon as you get this message."
Without trying to analyze the reason she could be of help to him, Aline returned the call. When he heard her voice, Mike Wilson went straight to the point.
"Based on what I have learned so far, there were about 30 individuals at the party, and I have most of the names. I believe most of them were Carrie's year, which means they will be leaving imminently for college. I want to find out which colleges they are going to and when they will be leaving. For obvious reasons, I want to talk first to those leaving earliest. Can you help me with this?"
"I'm glad you called. I had totally forgotten I'm supposed to be at the high school at 1 o'clock today for an orientation meeting. I may be able to help you. Today's training would include instruction on how to use the computer system."
"Are you planning to go?"
"Frankly, I could use a little distraction. You asked about when colleges start. Here's a quick rule of thumb. Southern schools in mid-August, they're back already. Catholic schools around Labor Day. The Ivies in mid-September. Most of the others around now, the last week in August."
"I really appreciate this. I'm sorry to ask you to go in only a day after..."
She cut him off. "I'm glad to have something helpful to do. Text me the names and I'll get you the schools."
"That would be great, Ms. Dowling."
"Please, call me Aline."
"Okay, Aline. And one last request. Would you also have the dates of birth in your records? I have to know which ones are adults and which are minors."
"I can get those too. You'll have them by late afternoon." Aline felt strange as she maneuvered her car into a space reserved for faculty at the high school. The parking lot was nearly empty. She knocked on the half-open door to the principal's office. Pat Tarleton quickly rose from her desk, walked over, and embraced her.
I'm so sorry, honey. How are you and your parents doing?
We're all in shock, trying to absorb what happened. I thought it would be good to force my mind to focus on something else, so I wanted to keep our appointment. Pat guided Aline over to a chair next to hers, where they could both see the large screen on her desktop computer. She handed her a piece of paper with some scribbling on it.
This is your password to access our computer system. Let me show you how it works.
Aline quickly absorbed Pat's instructions. Fortunately, the system was very similar to the one she had used at the international school. When they were finished, Pat handed her a list she had printed out.
These are all the teachers and personnel at the school and their contact information.
As Aline skimmed the list, she was pleasantly surprised to see that many of the teachers she'd had were still at the school.
It feels like old home week, she told Pat as she attempted a smile.
Marge didn't know what to do.
Had that detective been able to see that Jamie wasn't telling the truth? The way Jamie kept looking at her for approval might be misinterpreted. That Detective Wilson seemed very smart.
As always, when she was upset, Marge reached for her rosary beads. Before she began to recite the first sorrowful mystery, the agony in the garden, she began to think of Jack. His image was never far from her heart and mind. She had met him at an amusement park in Rye. He was a senior at All Hallows High School, and she was a junior at St. Jean's. She lived in the Bronx and took the subway to school on East 75th Street in Manhattan. He lived on West 200th Street and would be going to Fordham in September. She told him that she was planning to go to Marymount in 2 years.
We didn't leave each other's side even for a minute until his group got back on the boat and the nuns called us to our bus. I thought Jack was the handsomest man I had ever laid eyes on, tall and with that blonde hair and blue eyes. Jamie is the image of him. He told me the Chapman name was on very old tombstones at Cape Cod, where his ancestors were buried. They weren't on the Mayflower, but they arrived not much after, Jack told me. He was so proud of that, she thought tenderly. My Irish father was from a farm family in Roscommon. He was younger than his brother, which meant his brother would inherit the farm. So when he was 20, he said goodbye to his parents, sisters, and brothers, and sailed to New York. He met my mother there, and they got married when she was 19 and he was 22. Like us, when we got married, Marge thought. I was 20 and left college after my sophomore year. Jack was 24. He had left college after his freshman year, deciding instead to get his electrician's license. He liked working in construction. Oh, Jack, I wish you were here now. We had given up hope of having a baby, and then when I was 45, I became pregnant. After all those years of hoping and then accepting that God didn't want to send us children, it was a miracle. We were so happy, she thought. Then we almost lost Jamie when he was born. He was deprived of oxygen, but he was ours. Jack had the heart attack and died when Jamie was 15. The poor little guy kept looking all over for him and crying, Daddy! Jack, I'm looking for you to help me now,
Marge prayed.
Maybe Jamie thought he was playing a game with Carrie, poor girl. But she had a blow on her head. He'd never do that, I'm sure of it. But the cops could twist his story if they knew he had been in the pool with her. Can you imagine him going to prison? He'd be so frightened. And men take advantage of a boy like him. It can't happen. It just can't happen.
Marge looked down at the rosary she was holding. As she began her prayer, Jamie came down from his room where he had been watching television.
I didn't tell anyone about going swimming with Carrie, he said. Wasn't that good?
16. Aline loved her grandparents. Both in their late 70s, they had moved to Arizona because of her grandmother's chronic arthritis. She had been sure that their arrival would combine both comfort and strained nerves. The minute they were in the door, her grandmother, shoulders slouching, her arthritic fingers clutching a cane, wailed,
"It should have been me! Why this beautiful child? Why? Why?"
Aline's first thought was, "Because you never go into pools." Her grandfather, strong and healthy for his age, said,
"I understand she was having a party when you people were away. That's what happens when kids are left unsupervised."
It was more of an accusation than a consolation.
"That's what I've been telling Steve," Fran chimed in.
Aline exchanged a glance with her father. She knew her grandparents had always felt her mother should have married the man she was briefly engaged to 30 years ago. He had gone on to work in Silicon Valley and was now a tech billionaire. Her father, a partner in an accounting firm, made a very good income, but it did not include a private plane, a yacht, a mansion in Connecticut, or a villa in Florence. Normally, her father let their criticism roll off his back. Aline was worried about how he would react this time. A roll of his eyes was their unspoken message.
"Don't worry. They'll be gone in 3 or 4 days."
On Wednesday, Aline suggested to her father that she go with him to make arrangements for a wake on Thursday and a funeral on Friday morning. She was afraid her mother would have a total breakdown if she had to choose a casket. But it was her mother who decided that Carrie would be buried in the gown she had worn to her senior prom. It was a beautiful, pale blue, full-length organdy, and Carrie had looked lovely in it. At 1 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, dressed in newly purchased black clothes, the family gathered solemnly in the funeral home. When Fran saw Carrie's body in the casket, she fainted.
"Why? Why?"
Aline's grandmother wailed as Steve caught his wife before she collapsed. But Fran did manage to find enough inner strength to be on the receiving line when visitors started arriving. As news cameras clicked from their locations across the street, the neighbors, teachers, and students from the high school and friends from long ago arrived. By 3 o'clock, the line looped around the block. Aline found herself watching to see if Alan Crowley would appear. But there was no sign of him. She didn't know whether to be relieved or angry. Remembering the way her mother felt about him, she knew it was better that he had not shown his face. Some of Carrie's former lacrosse team members arrived with the coach, Scott Kimball. He was an attractive man with a disciplined body and dark brown hair. Wearing high heels, Aline was eye level with him. He had tears in his eyes as he took Aline's hand on the receiving line.
"I know how you feel," he said. "My kid brother was killed by a hit-and-run driver when he was 15. There isn't a day goes by that I don't think of him."
It was impossible to imagine daily life without Carrie. The haunting question of who had murdered her was on everyone's mind. Aline heard her mother tell people she was absolutely convinced it was Alan Crowley.
"I was trying to keep her away from him," Fran murmured. "With all the boys who were interested in Carrie, why she chose that one, I don't know. He was always so jealous of her. He had a bad temper. Now look what he's done to her."
There was a hint of early September in the air on the morning of the funeral. Even though the sun was shining brightly, the breeze was cool. Following Carrie's casket up the aisle in the processional renewed Aline's sense of unreality and detachment.
"Carrie and I should be at the pool together, going over what stuff she should take to college," she thought. "Not here. Not here."
Father Frank's homily was comforting. As he said,
"We do not understand why these tragedies occur. It is only faith that gives us the comfort we need."
Father Frank told again the story of looking at life from the wrong side of the beautiful Persian rug. To Aline, it had even more meaning than when he was with them the day she found Carrie in the pool. The question of whether Alan would dare to show up was constantly on her mind. She watched as people approached the communion rail, but did not see him or his parents. That was a relief.
The sight of him would have driven Mom crazy, she thought.
But as Aline and her parents followed the casket out of the church, she did catch a glimpse of Alan. He was kneeling in the last pew in the far corner, his head buried in his hands. Because of her stepfather's job transfer, sophomore Valerie Long and her family had moved from Chicago to Saddle River. The transition was made even harder because they had moved over Christmas, and she had started at the high school in January. Tall for her age and looking younger than her 16 years, she had green eyes, jet black hair, and pale skin. The promise of future beauty was in her face. An only child, her widowed mother, had remarried when she was 5. Her stepfather was 20 years older than her mother. They rarely saw his 2 grown children who lived in California. Valerie was sure he considered her excess baggage. Her timid and retiring nature had resulted in extreme shyness. Last winter at school, Valerie had found herself outside already formed cliques and friendships. This made the adjustment even harder. It was in the spring that things began to change for her. Fast and well-coordinated, she had excelled at lacrosse freshman year at her previous school. She was hoping that if she made the team at Saddle River, that would create easy opportunities to make new friendships. As usual, things did not work out the way she expected. Coach Scott Kimball immediately recognized her talent and put her on the varsity squad. The varsity was all seniors except for 2 juniors and her. She would have preferred to play on the junior varsity with the sophomores and freshmen, but she didn't want to disappoint the coach or her teammates. It was Carrie, the team captain, who first admired Valerie's skill on the field and also recognized how shy she was. Carrie went out of her way to chat with Valerie and tell her how good she was. She became, in essence, her big sister and the closest thing Valerie had to a confidant. Carrie's sudden death was a stunning blow to Valerie. She could not bring herself to go to either the wake or the funeral, but stood alone across the street, watching the casket leaving the church and being lifted onto the hearse. When she walked away, she was still unable to feel the release of tears. 18. Marge's close friend was the Crowleys' housekeeper, Brenda. Brenda and her husband Kurt, a retired plumber, lived in Westwood, New Jersey, a few miles from Saddle River. Kurt Niemeyer had often worked on construction projects with Jack Chapman. Like Jack and Marge, the Niemeyers had lived in a small Saddle River ranch house before the prices of real estate had gone up dramatically. They had sold and bought a house in nearby Westwood and a small place at the Jersey shore. While Kurt was enjoying retirement, Brenda found herself restless. In the early years of their marriage, she had been a housekeeper to bring in extra money. She realized she had enjoyed the work and was good at it.
Some people go to a gym. I get my exercise by cleaning.
She decided to look for that kind of work to fill her days. The result was she worked 3 days a week as a combination housekeeper and cook. She and Marge had remained close over the years, and when she confided gossip to Marge, Brenda knew it would not go any further. A medium-sized woman with short gray hair and narrow shoulders, she liked her job at the Crowleys, but did not like them. She considered June Crowley stuck up and cheap, and her husband full of himself and a total bore. The one person in the family she cared about was Alan.
The poor kid got stuck with those two. In their eyes, he can't do anything right. When he gets an A in school, it should have been an A+. I know he's got a temper, Brenda often thought to herself, but I swear those two drive him to it.
Their constant hope was that in September, Alan would be enrolled in an Ivy League college so they could brag to their friends.
They're always after him, Brenda confided to Marge. If I were in his boots, I'd have applied to the University of Hawaii just to get away from them. Of course, I wasn't there over the weekend when that poor girl was killed. But I gather that when the Crowleys found out that a cop had come over and talked to Alan, they hit the ceiling. And now all I hear around town is that everyone thinks that Alan did it. The way the Crowleys are carrying on, I swear. I wonder if they don't think so themselves.
The business of picking up the pieces after Carrie's death began to fall into place. Aline helped her mother with the personal notes to the people who had sent floral tributes to the wake. By unspoken understanding, they had closed the door to Carrie's room. The bed, still freshly made, was covered by the blue and white coverlet Carrie had chosen when she was 16. Her clothes were in the closet. The woolly Lassie dog that she had carried under her arm when she was a toddler was perched on a bench in front of the window. Originally, the plan was to place Lassie in the casket with her, but at the last minute, Fran had told Steve and Aline that she wanted to keep it. Fran had been adamant that they find a contractor to demo the pool, to remove any trace that it had ever existed. Steve had persuaded her to compromise. They would close the pool for the season. They would decide next spring if they should get rid of it. In these 10 days before school opened, Aline had tried to sort out her own thinking.
Carrie and I were different siblings hatched in the same nest, she thought. Carrie was so beautiful from the moment she opened her eyes.
Aline was 10 years old then, too skinny, with teeth that obviously would need to be straightened, and mousy brown hair that hung limp on her shoulders.
But I adored her. There wasn't ever sibling rivalry. It was just that we were two different people. I used to beg Mom to be the one who pushed her in the baby carriage. But then there were other differences. From day one, I was a voracious reader. I threw myself into books. I wanted to be Jane Eyre or Catherine running on the moors with Heathcliff. I wanted to show how smart I was. From the first grade, I wanted to be first in the class, and I made it. The only sport I got into was tennis, and I loved it because it was so competitive. 40 Love was music to my ears. Columbia was my first choice for college, and I got in. Then a master's degree in psychology. And then becoming engaged to Rick. He was a graduate student when we met. And then that was it for both of us. His height made me feel small. So protected. He was relatively local, from Hastings-on-Hudson, only 40 minutes from Saddle River. Rick used to say his ambition was to get his doctorate and then teach in college, Aline mused. I told him I wanted to teach in high school and or become a guidance counselor. I had just completed my master's and he his doctorate when we set the date for our wedding. 4 years ago. We had made all the arrangements for the big day. Mom and I picked out my gown. I was going to wear her veil, Aline remembered. We had dinner here that night, and then Rick drove home. The call from his father had come 3 hours later. Rick had a head-on collision with a drunk driver and died in the hospital. The drunk driver didn't have a scratch. How did I pick up the pieces? Aline asked herself. I knew I had to get away. That was why I took the job at the International School in London. 3 years ago. Only coming home for Thanksgiving and Christmas. 3 years of waiting for the pain to ease, and then finally beginning to wake up in the morning without Rick being the first thought on my mind. 3 years of casual dates since then, but never any interest in letting them progress. And this last year the need had come to be home, to be in daily contact with her parents and all the friends she had left behind. Instead, she had returned to find the little sister she loved, a murder victim. There is something I can do, she thought, and that is to be here for them.
She had intended to get her own apartment in Manhattan, but that could wait. Who had taken Carrie's life? Who could have done that to someone who had so much promise? Who had her whole life to live.
It's not going to happen again, Aline vowed. Whoever took Carrie's life is going to pay the price for it. I like Mike Wilson. I think he's smart and capable. But how can I help him?
There was one possible way. Most of the kids who were at the party would be back in school. If any of them knew more than they were telling Mike and the other cops, maybe they'd be more loose-lipped as time passed.
The police may be zeroing in on Alan Crowley, Aline thought. But from what I gather, the evidence against him is strong, but not overwhelming.
Since graduating from high school, Aline had remained in close touch with the principal, Pat Tarleton. A month earlier, Pat had emailed her about an opening in the guidance department. Would she be interested? It was the job she wanted, and the timing was right. With Carrie having graduated, she would be spared the awkwardness of having her big sister work at the same school. 20. Marge was living in a state of suspended animation. Instinctively, she had felt that when Detective Wilson stopped in the day Carrie's body was found, he had observed Jamie looking for her approval. Although she believed he had not told anyone about going into Carrie's pool, it was always possible he would blurt it out to someone. It didn't help that sometimes out of the blue he would refer back to it with her.
"Mom, I didn't tell anybody about going swimming with Carrie."
Her reassurances were quick and hushed.
"That's our secret, dear. We don't talk about secrets."
Every day when she left him at the Acme Market, she held her breath until she picked him up. Without realizing why, she found herself driving him both ways instead of letting him walk. As soon as he got home, she would ask him who he had talked to at work and what they had spoken about. Sometimes he would finish his answer with a triumphant smile.
"And I didn't tell anybody I went swimming with Carrie."
Marge was conflicted. She wanted to keep track of anyone he was speaking to. On the other hand, were these conversations making him think even more about what happened the night Carrie died? It made things worse when he suddenly began to talk about the big guy in the woods. Jack's affectionate nickname for Jamie was the big guy. Trying to sound casual, she asked him,
"What about the big guy, Jamie?"
"He hit Carrie and pushed her in the pool," he said matter-of-factly.
Marge forced herself to ask,
"Jamie, who is the big guy?"
"Daddy called me the big guy. Remember, Mom?"
Her throat went dry. Marge whispered,
"I remember, Jamie. I remember."
Marge knew that she could not bear the burden alone. Her consuming worry was that the police might try to blame Jamie, especially since he had told them about swimming with Carrie. But she knew it wasn't right to hide the truth from them. The previous evening, Jamie had told her a big guy had come around from the bushes after the first guy left, and he had hit Carrie on the head and pushed her in the pool. But if Jamie told that to the police, they would compare him to Alan Crowley. Alan was medium height and on the thin side. Jamie was 6'1" and not fat, but broad.
"Sometimes he calls himself Big Guy," Marge thought. "If he says this to the police, they might think that the big guy Jamie was describing was actually Jamie himself. If they believe that, they might arrest him. He'd be so frightened. He's so easily manipulated. He always wants to please. He'll happily say anything they want to hear."
Marge felt again the familiar tightness in her chest. Her doctor had warned her to take a nitroglycerin tablet whenever that happened. By the end of the day, she had taken 3 tablets.
"Dear God, don't let anything happen to me," she begged. "He needs me now more than ever."
21. Mike's next stops were the homes of the 4 girls who had texted Carrie after the party. Each set of their parents had agreed to allow their daughter to talk. He rang the bell of Betsy Finley and met her and her parents. He was invited to come into the living room. Betsy sat on a couch wedged between her parents. Wilson settled into a chair opposite the couch. He began by saying, as Detective Harsh had said during his interviews, that he had no intention of arresting anyone solely for drinking or having any drugs, but that it was very important that Betsy be honest with him. He emphasized that his only interest was in finding out what had happened to Carrie. He tried to make his questions sound casual. After Betsy sheepishly admitted that she had one or two vodkas, they established what time Betsy got to the party and what time she left. Wilson asked,
"Were there any fights or disagreements at the party?"
Of course, Betsy immediately told him that Alan and Carrie had an argument because Carrie and Chris Coble were flirting with each other. And after the quarrel, Alan left before anyone else. She told Mike that everyone else left in a group because Carrie wanted them all out by 11 o'clock. The interview turned out to be simply a verification of what Mike knew from the texts and his interview of Alan. His final question was,
"Do you know who brought in the beer and vodka?"
It drew a shake of Betsy's head.
"It was already there when I arrived, and I was the first one to get to the party."
Similar answers came from the next two girls who had texted Carrie. The one who'd sent the "dump Alan" text heatedly exclaimed that Alan wasn't just upset or annoyed. He was ballistic. It was the last girl who had texted Carrie after the party who proved the most valuable to Mike. When he asked her who brought the liquor to the party, her answer was,
"Carrie told me that the guy who fixed the flat tire on her car had told her that any time she had a party, he could get her whatever alcohol she wanted."
Mike did not show any change of expression.
"Do you know the name of the guy who changed the flat?"
"I don't."
"Did Carrie describe him or say where she met him?"
"I think she got the flat on Route 17 in Mahwah, and he pulled over to help."
"Did she say where she met him to get the alcohol for the party?"
"No, but she did tell me that when she met him to pick it up, he put it in her trunk. Then when she closed the trunk, he asked her if he could come to the party. She told him it was just for her high school friends. There wouldn't be anybody his age there. Carrie said this guy was about 25. Then he said, 'Well, maybe we can get together after your friends go home.' Of course she said no. Then he grabbed her and started kissing her."
"Did she ever describe this guy to you?"
"No. Right after she told him to get lost, she told me she got in her car and drove off."
"So she didn't say where she met him to pick up the alcohol?"
"I don't think she did. I can't remember."
He looked at her parents.
"I'm very grateful to have had this opportunity to talk with your daughter."
He said goodbye and left to go back to his car. As he drove away, he could only think about the fact that there might just be yet another potential suspect in Carrie Dowling's murder. 22. The sun was streaming through the windows of the rectory. Marge sat opposite Father Frank in his office. Instead of sitting behind his desk, he had pulled up a chair closer to her.
"Marge, I'm happy you've come to see me. I could tell from your voice on the phone that you are very upset. What's wrong?"
"Jamie, he's in trouble."
There was a pause, and then Marge, her voice trembling, began,
"Father, from his window, Jamie was watching the party at Carrie Dowling's house. When she fell or was pushed into the pool, he thought she went swimming and went over to swim with her."
"Did he tell you that?"
"Not at first. The next morning, I noticed that his slacks were wet and so were his socks and sneakers. When I asked him about it, he told me he had seen someone come up behind Carrie, hit her, and push her in the pool. Still thinking he could go swimming with her, he walked down the steps to the pool."
Marge took a deep breath.
"I didn't know what to do, Father. I watched that awful scene of Steve Dowling and Aline finding Carrie in the pool. I was afraid. Afraid for Jamie. His sneakers and pants had stains on them. Maybe it was wrong, but I washed them. I had to protect Jamie. I made Jamie promise not to talk to anybody about what happened that night."
"Marge, what Jamie saw could be very helpful to the police."
"Yes, but it could also get Jamie in a lot of trouble if they think he did it."
Marge drew a deep breath.
"Father, that's not all. Remember how Jack always called Jamie Big Guy?"
"Of course I remember."
"And now Jamie has been talking to me about the big guy who pushed Carrie into the pool. Alan Crowley is average height and has a thin build. Jamie sometimes talks about himself as the big guy. He can get mixed up if he's upset. I'm so afraid that if he ever tells that to the police,
Marge's voice trailed off.
Marge, is there any chance Jamie might have hurt Carrie?
Jamie was disappointed and maybe even angry that he wasn't invited to the party, but I can't see him ever hurting her.
But when Jamie said a big guy pushed Carrie in the pool, do you think he may have been talking about himself?
Marge sighed.
I don't know what to think. He loved her. I can't believe he would hurt her. A detective came by and spoke to us. I don't think he suspects Jamie, but I just don't know.
Marge, I don't want to give you quick advice that might turn out to be wrong. Let me think about what we've discussed.
Thank you so much, Father. And please, pray for me. And for Jamie.
I will, Marge. I promise.
23. Excited by the start of a new school year, students poured back into the hallways. As they passed Aline, many of them stopped to tell her how sorry they were about Carrie. Aline tried to keep her eyes from welling up as one after the other they told her they couldn't believe what had happened to her sister.
Neither can I,
was her answer. The day passed by in a blur. After the school buses had come and gone and the teachers began to go home, Aline sat in her office. She tried to familiarize herself with the names of this year's seniors. She knew that one of her jobs would be to help them finalize which colleges they would apply to. She was troubled by the fact that the first thing she had done on the computer was to look up the information requested by Mike Wilson. She worried that if they found out what she had given to the detective, her first day at Saddle River High School could be her last. She hoped not. There was a tap on her door. Pat Tarleton opened it and came in.
So, Aline, how did the first day go?
As well as can be expected, Aline said wryly. That said, it feels good to be here. And I'm looking forward to getting to know the students and my fellow faculty.
Speaking of that, I noticed that you and Scott Kimball were chatting in the teacher's lounge together. He's been a great addition to the faculty this past year. His math classes have been very popular with the students. And he's been a godsend for the girls' lacrosse program.
He had some of the players at the wake with him, Aline said, her tone noncommittal.
And I remember Carrie talking about what a great coach he was. Okay, I just wanted to pop by.
See you in the AM. The door had barely closed behind Pat when Aline's cell phone rang. It was Mike Wilson.
Aline, when Carrie was in touch with you, whether by phone, text, or email, did she ever mention somebody stopping to help her with a flat?
In her mind, Aline raced through her recent emails from Carrie.
No, I don't recall that.
I assume there's a reason you're asking.
I'm just trying to be thorough. One of Carrie's friends told me that someone who helped her change a flat got a little aggressive with her after she refused to invite him to the party. It's probably nothing, but I want to find out that person's name.
Do you think he may have been the one who...
Aline, we follow up on anything that might turn out to be relevant. That's why I need to ask your folks about the flat tire.
Of course.
How are they doing?
I know going back to work is helping my father. My mother is pretty bad.
Will they be home this evening? Carrie might have talked to them about the flat and who helped her. Do you know what time might be convenient for them?
Dad is usually home by 6:30. We never eat before 7:30. I would say about 6:45.
Fine. I'll see you then as well.
Aline pushed the button to power down her computer. She was about to get out of her chair when there was another knock on the door. Scott Kimball came into her office. The lacrosse coach was also a mathematics instructor, teaching courses in algebra, geometry, and calculus. It was the beginning of his second year at this school. He had been hired a year earlier to replace a retiring teacher, and the athletic director had been delighted to find in Kimball someone who had played lacrosse and was willing to coach it. He was quickly made head coach of the girls' varsity squad.
"Just a social visit," he said. "How is it going?"
My grandparents have gone back to Arizona. I'll miss them, but in a way, it's easier. My dad went back to work. My mother is having a really hard time. Of course, we all are. But she's determined to keep as busy as possible.
Aline, I know the timing may not be right. It might be premature, but I'm going to plow forward anyway. I would very much enjoy taking you to dinner. I've been dying to try a new French restaurant that opened right on the Hudson in Nyack. I'm told the food and the view are both great.
Aline hesitated. Undoubtedly, Scott was an attractive man. But she wasn't sure if it was wise to socialize. Oh, come on, call it what it really is. Date a fellow staffer. I'm not ready yet, but can we talk about it in a couple weeks?
Absolutely. As you know, I'll be around.
With a wave, he left her office. Aline thought of Carrie's reaction to Kimball at the end of last season.
He's a great coach and a really nice guy. He was so much better than the former coach, Don Brown, who had no idea what he was doing.
Score one for you, Carrie, Aline thought. It seems like you would have approved of my joining Scott Kimball for dinner at the restaurant with the great view. She locked her door behind her and headed out to the parking lot. 24. True to his word, Mike Wilson rang the doorbell at precisely 6:45. Aline had told her parents that he wanted to stop in. Her mother's reaction was instant.
He's going to tell us that they've arrested Alan Crowley.
No, it's not about that at all. It's just a question he has for you. Steve asked,
about Carrie?
Yes, it's about a flat tire Carrie had.
Carrie never had a flat tire, Steve said firmly.
Well, tell Detective Wilson that. When Mike arrived, Aline wanted to avoid having the meeting in the family room. That was where the three of them had been sitting when Mike told them that Carrie's death was not an accident. Instead, she suggested that they go into the living room. When they were seated, Mike explained the reason for the meeting, reporting what he had told Aline. Steve said firmly,
Carrie said nothing about getting a flat, but I had told her that the rear tire on her car was looking threadbare, and I wanted her to go to the dealer and have it changed right away. If she had a flat before she took care of it, she would not have wanted to tell us about it. Did she ever get a new tire?
Mike asked.
She showed me she got the new one about 10 days ago.
Doesn't that narrow the time when she met whoever changed the flat and sold her the beer for the party? Aline asked.
And then tried to force himself on her? Steve said bitterly. Yes, assuming she got the replacement tire right after getting the flat.
Mike got up.
This could be very helpful in following up on whoever that guy is.
The only one you should be concentrating on is Alan Crowley, Fran said firmly, as her eyes filled with tears.
Aline walked Mike to the door.
I wonder if Mom is right about Alan Crowley, she asked.
We try to avoid fixating on one obvious suspect. We're determined to pursue any relevant leads.
He repeated the question Pat Tarleton had asked.
How did your first day go?
A little overwhelming, of course. But I have a question. Does anyone else know I gave you the information about the birth dates and where they're going to college?
No one knows where I got that information.
Good. If it's okay, I'd like to keep it that way.
Absolutely.
Good night. Aline watched his retreating figure and waited until he stepped into the car and drove away. Valerie endured the first day of school as though she were walking in her sleep. Every step of the way it felt like Carrie was there. Carrie on the lacrosse field, Carrie walking with her arm around her as they headed to the locker room. Inside, Valerie so much wanted to be able to cry. But somehow the tears were all stuck in her throat. As she was changing classes, she saw Carrie's sister, the new guidance counselor, in the corridor. She was wearing a dark blue jacket and slacks. As she passed her, Valerie thought she was so pretty. She was taller than Carrie, and her hair was dark brown, but they still looked a lot alike.
I'm sorry, Carrie, Valerie thought. I'm so sorry.
25. As they had planned, Alan Crowley's parents met the well-known defense lawyer Lester Parker. A reluctant Alan accompanied them.
Alan, let us go over what happened at the party, Parker began.
Carrie Dowling was your girlfriend, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
How long were the two of you, in a relationship?
A year.
Is it true you